gentlemen, to the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you go freaking nuts. And we're broadcasting live from the very special, fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chains nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which according to the Prime Minister John Key is good for the economy, because now everybody by proxy has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is known only as Nigel, and he's, well, and also there's this other, and by the way, I love the name Nigel, because of Nigel Farage, the UK Independence Party, calling the secretary of the EU Parliament a damp rag of some sort. So I've always had an affinity for the name Nigel ever since that moment. Well, welcome to the program, mate.
Ah, thanks, Benny. Yeah, I do actually have a surname. It's Waddington.
Right.
So Nigel Waddington, it's a frightfully British name, old boy.
Yeah.
Even if I have lived in Australia all my life.
Yeah, yeah. Well, why don't you elucidate on your local Aussie culture and then, you know, let us know who you are and what you do, because it's Anzac Day today.
Oh, yeah. Elucidate on the local Aussie culture. Oh, God, Lord, I'm beginning with something like that.
Well, let me see if I can sum it up for you. A desert surrounded by alcoholics.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, I don't drink that much alcohol, actually. But, yeah, there is that that element of Australian culture.
So you're the desert.
Could be looked at that way.
All right, the one sober man in a half-cut country. And over here, Anzac Day is all over. Like, it's a big New Zealand thing. I don't know how it is in Australia, bro, but it's all over the radio. You know, loving it. All the elderly calling in, talking about their brothers and their uncles and such like that fought in the war, and also mentioning that they never frickin' talk about it. You know why they never frickin' talk about it, don't you? Because if you talk about something, it's like reliving it. And who the hell wants to relive going through that kind of stuff?
Yes. Yeah. The unfortunate thing is that, with maybe a few rare exceptions, the Australian military has never actually been used to defend Australia itself. Tends to get used by the major powers to, you know, fight in skirmishes in various parts of the world. Although it does have to be said that, you know, some of those operations are relatively benign, like the operation in East Timor. Well, I say relatively benign. And certainly having known a number of people who are in the military, most people I've met in the Australian military are pretty decent.
Nigel, you've got to speak up a little bit.
Oh, okay. Yeah, unfortunately I don't have a direct microphone, so can you hear me properly now?
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, when you trail off and stuff like that, we can't hear the rest of it. Have you noticed as well, because this is the other thing that I've seen with the so-called Anzac spirit, is it gave us both national identities, didn't it? Really?
Yeah, well, New Zealand was originally supposed to be part of Australia. Like, if you actually look at the preamble to the Australian Constitution, it includes New Zealand. New Zealand was going to be one of the states. Now, I'm not sure what happened. I haven't looked into the history of it in detail, but... I think it might have been, you know, Australian mainland politicians making a fuss that prevented that from happening. But, I'm not. That's a bit of history I will have to research sometime.
Mm. Well, yeah. Apparently, it was one of the articles of the Constitution that New Zealand would be what's it called, the seventh state of Australia, and for all intents and purposes, still is. And New Zealanders and Australians, they traverse back and forth and things like that. Not a whole lot of visas and things of that nature really need to be applied for. It's pretty close-knit. Unfortunately, if New Zealanders come over there and don't get a job, they become homeless because they can't get access to any benefits. Which is fair enough, I guess. You know, you don't want foreigners coming into your country and then not working and suddenly getting all the benefits of the state without ever having paid tax for it. But then again, some of these other people, this was on the news a couple of nights ago, I think. Our guys have been working there for years, you know, in good, decent jobs, paying their taxes. And then when they lose their job and they only need like a month or two's living expenses so they can find another one, they're homeless, mate. And they can't be employed because, you know, who wants to go into a job interview unshaven, smelly and wearing rags?
Yeah. So you're asking, what the sort of thing we're going to discuss today?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, my background, I guess, I mean, a lot of people who come in and talk about the so-called New World Order or whatever you want to call it will say, oh, you know, I was, you know, very high up in this organisation and I did this or blah, 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 blah. Well, no, I don't have any of that. I'm just simply an independent person who occasionally does some research and stumbles across things. And talked about it. And, yeah, no, so I'm not like a famous name or anything of that nature. And one of my interests, one of my many interests, is the politics, or what I call the politrics, surrounding events in the Middle East. And also, within the so-called truth movement, I've probably got to stop using that term because I'm actually seriously wondering whether there's even really any such thing as a truth movement. Is the deployment
of didn't we have a conversation about this earlier and I dubbed it the half truth movement?
Yeah, but a half truth could be said to be a whole lie, and that would probably be an appropriate description for it because the so-called truth movement is so flooded with propaganda coming from outfits such as the CIA and all different kinds of propaganda on all sorts of different issues, but one of the ones that's of particular interest to me is the deployment of anti-Zionist and sometimes outright anti-Semitic propaganda. We've now even got to the point where, like on email lists I'm on, there are people who are not only saying that the Nazi Holocaust, you know, didn't happen, right? There are now people starting to say that, oh, Hitler wasn't such a bad guy because he stood up to the Jewish bankers. So, you know, it's absolute nonsense. And what's the real concern is that so many people in the so-called truth movement are tolerating this.
There's a lot of belief out there, and despite the fact that the truth movement prides itself on being people who base their decisions on facts, evidence, that kind of thing, it's just simply not the case, and it's actually mostly done on belief. Most of the facts and things of that nature that we're going off quoting all the time, we've never actually done the background research on, don't actually know. And so you have to ask yourself, it's the old tale, I think. What was his name? The guy who wrote Tom Sawyer.
Mark Twain?
Mark Twain, yeah. Now, he says, when an honest man is confronted with the truth that he's wrong, he will either cease to be wrong or cease to be honest.
That's exactly right. And one of the problems is with... I'll call it the truth movement for now, just because people kind of know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, we've got to come up with a new term. It's an entertainment movement. It's full of entertainment junkies. And it is so flooded with, you know, information, quote-unquote, that there's no way that most people can really check all their facts. And they just start to believe them. So, I mean, I've made a point of not looking into the Boston bombings so far. But, you know, already it's just... Yeah, as it's predicted, as soon as I heard on the mainstream news that there'd been this bombing in Boston, I thought, oh, God. I knew straight away there are going to be people who will say that it didn't happen, it was all actors. I knew there were people who were going to automatically say it's a false flag. I knew that there were going to be people who were going to say that there's a terrorist drill happening at the same time, and I knew all of these things were going to come out.
You know what I knew? Now, I knew there'd be some people who say, I'm not really going to say anything until the facts come out. Like Suzanne Posel at Occupy Corporatism, that's what she said to me when I asked her about it.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly not going to say anything substantive about it until the facts come out. For the simple fact, I don't know. And it seems to me like the theme, for example, of terrorist drills happening at the same time as actual terrorist events, it's like it's a common meme that is deployed every time there's some sort of terrorist attack. That's not to say that it's not true, but it's got to be questionable. It's almost as though, you know, there's these prepackaged themes ready to go whenever these various events happen, because they've basically painted the target audience or different target audiences, and they know exactly what sort of memes, therefore what sort of propaganda to throw at them to direct them down whatever garden path they want to direct them down.
You know, this reminds me of telemarketers. When you ask them certain questions, they've got a list. They've got a script of a list of responses to, you know, each of the questions and things like that. So when everybody says, "Oh, it might be a false flag," again, like you say, they just go to the script. Ah, here we go. There's something that we've said before 100 times on mainstream news that seemed to quiet everybody down. How about that?
Yeah, and also standard replies for the so-called alternative media. I mean, listening to some of the muckraking radio from America from the 1980s was a vastly superior quality to what we've got now. It would seem to me that the COINTELPRO or whatever name they call the operation these days, but to the same effect, injecting counterintelligence or pro-stupidity into the general public in various ways, has been quite successful in dumbing down the resistance to what I call the globalist criminal syndicate.
Distracting them, in other words, from the proper objective, which is to indeed overthrow the globalists and stop their tyranny from being put in place and exterminating everybody. Is that about right?
Well, more or less. Certainly standing up to the tyranny. And, distraction is certainly a part of it, but also a lot of it's deception, decoys, diverting people's attention onto decoys. Various agendas are served by it. But my particular interest is the role of anti-Semitic and the more politically correct version, anti-Zionist propaganda into the so-called truth movement. And not just the truth movement. Pretty much across the political spectrum, there's an anti-Zionist theme for just about every mindset.
Well, how could you actually explain that? Hold on, let me make a point as well. Distraction and entertainment you were talking about, and that's what a lot of the movement has become. I sort of noticed that I was doing that early before I started, you know, making the videos and the radio shows and all of that kind of thing. I realized that just watching and consuming everybody else's content and never going out and making any of my own to contribute, that I was simply being distracted from participating through the entertainment value of what I was watching, what I was listening to. And now I'm trying to entertain and distract people myself.
Well, that's a paradox. I don't have a simple answer for it. I mean, I haven't actually personally made a YouTube video for a couple of years now, though I do plan on getting back into it very soon. I guess the idea is your intent to distract people, quote unquote, beyond entertainment. There's nothing wrong with entertainment either. There's nothing worse than watching you know, so-called conspiracy videos that are really badly made and are really boring. So there's nothing wrong with entertainment per se. I guess the problem is when it becomes amusement. And apparently the etymology of the word...
I'm really stiffening it now.
No, amusement.
Muse. Yeah, I know.
You're
talking to Aslan.
The etymology of the word amusement, we've got muse, which is to think, amuse, which is to not think, and ment, process. So amusement is the process of not thinking.
How interesting. Well, that's a good place to leave the show on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you are amused by the Vinnie Eastwood show anyway. But please, keep thinking about how much it actually is good to deal with nasty stuff that's going on in your life by having a few laughs about it and getting over it and getting out there again. We'll be right back after the break.
I got some so-called friends. Smile right to my face. All when my back is turned. They like to bury me without a trace. Oh, no, no. Oh, no, no. There's only one thing I need to know. Who's that? Are you?
Welcome back. Whose side are you on, ladies and gentlemen? Are you the side that will admit when you're wrong and just go, hey, you know what? I was wrong, and all those previous things that I've said suddenly just don't apply anymore. And I'm going to start now talking about what I found out was the truth. Or are you one of the people who would defend how wrong you are and try to be an apologist for it and keep spreading the disinfo anyway? Pick a side. My very special guest is Nigel Waddington. Nigel, welcome back.
Hey, Vinny, how you doing?
Somewhat fabulous is my standard response.
Yes, it is about admitting when one's mistaken and moving on. As I found out, well, quite a few years ago now, back in the days when I was an anti-Zionist myself. And to cut a long story short, I would have gone down the anti-Zionist path in about 1989, 1990. For those old enough to remember, this was shortly after the so-called First Intifada, which appeared on mainstream news and so on. And at that time, I had a sister who was overseas, and among the many things she did was go and work on a moshav in Israel. A moshav is a bit like a kibbutz, but a more commercial version of it. Anyway, she came back.
I don't have any idea what a kibbutz actually is.
Oh, right. Well, without going into laborious detail, it's basically sort of like a communal farm. That's a bit of an oversimplification, but that's basically what it is.
Yeah. All righto.
And not just farms. Sometimes it's, you know, factories and things like that as well. But anyway, she came back from overseas, and you know, she'd been to Israel and asked her, you know, what's going on over there. And he was basically coming out with what I call, you know, standard Zionist platitudes. That, the Israelis, the Jews, they've been so persecuted, and they came here and they built up the land and so on and so forth. And all of which is actually quite true, but it is, when put like that, essentially little more than a platitude. And she also went on to say, and the Arabs are somewhat underdogs, but you can't give them too much, but they'll take too much. Da, da, da. Now, none of this particularly impressed me very much, because it was a similar sort of theme to that which Australian racists would say about what some people call the Australian Aboriginals, or the original inhabitants of this land. The same sort of thing. But none of that really impressed me too much. And then I ended up getting my hands on a book put out by this mob called the International Socialist Organization. It was called Israel, the Hijacked State. And the International Socialist Organization purports not to be anti-Semitic. In fact, they're very strongly anti-Nazi and so on and so forth. But I didn't pick it up at the time, but in retrospect, looking at the picture they had on the front of their book was a very anti-Semitic theme. It had a picture of Uncle Sam struggling to hold back like this snarling bulldog with a Star of David on it. In other words, it was giving a subliminal message that Israel is this crazy state that even the big bad imperialist United States has trouble keeping under control. And and I read this book and basically went down the anti-Zionist path. And of course, I was I was into a lot of the work of Noam Chomsky at the time too. So I read his works on it and so on and so forth. All of this
we have we have a garden Noam Chomsky in our backyard.
Yeah, well, he'd be more useful to humanity as a garden gnome, I think. And I say that as someone who really used to admire him. These days I'm actually, pretty much convinced that he's working for US counterintelligence, but that's a whole other story. But one of the things that really started to turn me around was, in the wake of the 9/11 attack, and I saw, on the day of that attack, or it was Nike, I was trying to watch Star Trek and turned on to find the Klingons had flown to the World Trade Center. And I knew that there was something wrong about it. I knew they were going to blame Osama bin Laden, and I knew they were going to invade Afghanistan. And the reason I knew that wasn't because I was, some great prophet, but because not all that long earlier, I've been reading articles about how there were plans for the US to make moves into Central Asia. And I remember when I was reading those articles, I thought, I wonder what sort of excuse they're going to need for that, and all of a sudden this happened. So I kind of knew that was what the results were going to be. And I thought there's something wrong about this whole 9/11 thing, the way it's playing out. I couldn't put my finger on it. But shortly in the wake of it, as more and more facts and details start to come out, one of the themes that started to come out was the notion that the Israelis were behind 9/11. And there was talk about, you may have heard the story about the dancing Israelis and
outside 9/11 they had like a film camera and they were dancing around celebrating when the towers got hit.
Yeah, that's how the story goes, yes. A very strange thing for people who just pulled off the biggest terrorist attack in history to be doing, really, to be filming it from a distance and dancing. And it's also very funny, that story about how supposedly bomb-sniffing dogs sniff their bands and smell traces of explosives when, for a start, as a lot of evidence now shows, it wasn't a controlled demolition per se. It was something else. Dr. Booty would call it the directed energy weapon. Whatever one wants to call it, the effects of the 9/11 attack are not consistent with either plane crashes and fuel weakening the steel or with controlled demolition. So the whole question about explosives is exactly that, a question. But furthermore, if explosives were used, it would seem a bit strange that people would be driving around with explosives tainted bands on the morning of the attack. So, there's a whole heap of weird anomalies, right? But this notion that the Israelis pulled off 9/11 was gaining traction. And I also was noticing on a lot of forums that anti-Zionists, and I was still an anti-Zionist at the time, were saying all sorts of outrageous things. And I thought, hang on, what's going on here? And then in 2002, there was the so-called Jenin massacre. This was supposedly the Israeli military had gone into the Jenin refugee camp and massacred, 500 plus Palestinian civilians. Right? And this was on the mainstream news. And I remember at the time, I was under the impression that the Western media was pro-Israel. So I thought, if even the Western media is saying this, probably even worse. And then all of a sudden, the facts came out that it wasn't a massacre at all, it was a fight involving the death of about 56 Palestinians, most of whom were involved in fighting, so they weren't defenseless civilians, and something like 23 Israeli soldiers. So I thought, hang on, How did that get turned into an absolute massacre? You know, and by the mainstream media, no less. That's when I started looking into things a bit further and finding that almost everything I'd believed about Israel and Zionism and the relationship between, for example, the United States and Israel, were wrong. And the effect of having this faulty intelligence, if you like, this counterintelligence, is to create absurdities within one's mind. And I've forgotten who it was who said this, but they were correct, that anyone who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. And that, I would say, is one of the key purposes, overarching purposes, behind the counterintelligence movement's injection of anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic themes and memes into not just the so-called truth movement, but pretty much across the political spectrum.
Yeah.
Questions, Vinny?
No, just keep going.
Oh, well, there are so many directions I could take this.
Because I would presume most people know the anti-Zionist standpoint. You know, they're getting money from the United States, they're killing the Palestinians, they set up checkpoints, committing atrocities, UN war crimes, and la, la, la. And it's a blockade. Gaza's an open air prison. They're being oppressed. There's two forms of Israeli and Palestinian citizenship, and pregnant women are having to give birth before they get through checkpoints that take 4, 5, 8 hours or something like that. You know, the whole deal. Massive, massive, massive. Like, oh my God, they're terrible people. Mm. What's the counter argument?
And
more to the point, you know, because you can go through those elements. So Gaza is an open-air prison camp. What would you say to that?
Well, I will first qualify that by saying I have not personally been to Gaza. However, what I can say is this. Well, I'll ask you a kind of a rhetorical question. How many Palestinians have died of starvation since Israel took over Gaza from Egypt in 1967 and took over the West Bank from Jordan in 1967. How many Palestinians do you think have starved to death?
Don't know. I haven't seen the statistics on it.
Zero. So there's this notion that Israel is starving Gaza. Now, I'm certainly not about to go and say that the situation in Gaza is all hunky-dory by any stretch. However, a number of points have to be made. For a start, a lot of people have forgotten that in 2005, the Israeli military ethnically cleansed over 5,000, I think it was 8,000 Jews from Gaza. You heard me correctly. The Israeli military, you know, the so-called Jewish army, ethnically cleansed around 5,000 to 8,000 Jews from Gaza. So there are no Jews living in Gaza. So it opens up a whole heap of questions of why the state of Israel did that.
They ethnically cleansed them. They actually killed them.
No, ethnic cleansing doesn't necessarily mean killing. No, they removed them by force. And as they didn't resist in any meaningful way, no, they were shot. I think most of the people who were cleansed, most of the Jews who were cleansed from Gaza are living at the fringes of Israeli society now, like living in poverty. That's a whole mess in itself. And a lot of their equipment, you know, farming equipment and so on and so forth, of course, was left behind, and most of it was destroyed by the various so-called Palestinian militant factions or whatever. So Israel is not occupying Gaza. That's one thing that needs to be made clear. Another thing is, you go to the website GazaToday.com. I've forgotten whether there's a hyphen in between Gaza Today, but either way, it's a Palestinian website. It's a tourist website. It's advertising Gaza as a tourist spot. You can find on the web all sorts of pictures of an Olympic-sized swimming pool and shopping malls and the whole bit. Now, that in and of itself doesn't prove any, you know, doesn't prove a great deal, but it does show that, well, if it's an open-air prison camp run by the Israelis, then how the hell can they be building Olympic-sized swimming pools and shopping malls, and then there's pictures of markets, absolutely chockers full of food. Gaza is now essentially in the hands of Hamas, who's linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, and often Hamas is made out to be an adversary of Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority. And while I'm sure at the lower levels they are, the fact is that at the highest levels, officials from Hamas and Fatah will change places with each other and that sort of thing. Yeah, and if Gaza is this open-air prison camp, then how can it be that, you know, because you can certainly get, you know, YouTube videos out of there, you know, that there are a few of them on the web. You would think that you know, all this horrendous sort of thing would be available for the world to see, you know, via YouTube and so on. And also, there's numerous so-called, you know, international solidarity activists going there. Very strange thing. Like, you know, you'll often hear stories of what they call it, the ISM, the International Solidarity Movement, sending activists, mainly from the United States and Britain, into areas where the Israeli military are, and on a few rare occasions, some of them have got killed in crossfires and that sort of thing. But what I would say is, well, hang on, what would be... Look, yeah, how many international solidarity movement type activists went and stood in front of any American tanks in Iraq, or would stand before American, or for that matter, Taliban troops in Afghanistan, or would go, like, what? How many war zones in the world can you go to as a political activist with minimal risk of being killed?
You know what? That's a very interesting question. I'd like to find out so I can go there, because my GoPro camera has an explosion-proof housing and I need to do some field tests. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Do you know whose side are you on? Welcome back, everybody. My very special guest... Nigel Waddington, we're talking about the very interesting situation in Israel, because technically Gaza and the West Bank and quote-unquote Palestine is Israel at the moment, according to all drawn maps and what have you anyway, and how there's basically, in my opinion, extremists and propagandists on both sides, so that nobody's getting the straight story from either side, so nobody knows really what's going on. What would you say to that, Nigel?
In essence, it's correct. Though the so-called extremists in Israel are a margin. Like, I mean, you will be able to find examples of very racist Jews, but they're marginal. The Israeli government, which is in control of the state of Israel, or reportedly in control, are essentially a bunch of globalist puppets who the main anti-Zionist line on the Israeli government suggests that, you know, this brutal imperialist colonialist type outpost. In actual fact, the Israeli government are facilitating what I believe the destruction of Israel. But perhaps it might be a good idea to discuss some of the historical context of the history of anti-Semitism and why it's there, because that confuses a lot of people too. Like, you'll often hear people saying things like, oh, the Jews have been kicked out of all these different countries, they must be doing something wrong, right? Well, no. I believe that the, you know, based on, you know, historical research, that the main reason there is anti-Semitism, the main reason why the Jewish people have been repeatedly attacked throughout history for the last 2,000 or so years, is because the Jewish movement, like, if you want to look at, I'm not talking so much about the religious side of it, but the how Jewish culture manifests itself politically, has traditionally been anti-tyrant. It has been a threat to tyranny. Like, the story of Moses and so on is the story of resistance and escape from a tyrannical pharaoh. Like, whether one believes the story is true or not doesn't really matter. That's the story. Right? Now, back in the days of the Roman Empire, when the Roman Empire, or the Greco-Roman Empire, I should say, was essentially in control in the Middle East and the Mediterranean, the Jewish movement was something of a political threat to them, because both Greece and ancient Greece and ancient Rome were essentially slave empires. They were built on enslaving people, and life for the average person in the Roman and Greek empires is pretty abysmal. And yet, some of the various peoples around the Mediterranean would be attending synagogues. I've forgotten what the name of them was. There was a special name for them. They were Gentiles, but they were allowed into synagogues to watch debates between rabbis and that sort of thing. And they would be getting the message that, hey, you're a human being. You have rights. You don't need to be treated like crap, basically. And this notion is becoming increasingly popular. And this became a threat to the Roman Empire. And ultimately, it culminated in the first genocide against the Jews in 70 AD, when the Romans destroyed their temple, killed huge amounts of them. Like, even though it wasn't in direct numbers the same amount as the Nazis, proportionally speaking, it was possibly even worse, considering that the Romans didn't have modern technology to carry out their extermination. And a lot of them were scattered throughout the world. So, there are Jewish communities in Europe and so on after that. And ever since then, what you could call the Greco-Roman elites, and I'm not necessarily talking about Greco-Roman elites literally, but tyrannical elites, found it to be in their interest to spread propaganda against the Jews, to convince ordinary Gentiles that the Jews were a threat in some sort of a way. They're poisoning the well. That was the story during the days of the Black Plague. The Jews are causing the plague. It becomes, they're running the banks, or they're doing this, or they're doing that. And that continues to this day. And what one of the questions people should ask themselves, because one of the ways I put it to people is, okay, let's just assume for a moment that Israel is the total bad guy in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Let's just pretend that for a moment. The fact is that compared to conflicts all over the world, the Arab-Israeli conflict has killed relatively few people, yet there's all this focus on it. Not only the mainstream media, but the alternative media, the United Nations. You'll get the so-called United Nations Human Rights Council, which is stacked full of the most tyrannical regimes.
Let's just compare this for a second. Let's just compare this to a second to Americans in Iraq. 1 million dead Iraqis, about a quarter of the babies are born deformed from depleted uranium. It's no fracking we're near that bad in Gaza, is it? There's not 33 people being killed in car bombs in a day?
Yeah, no. One thing that is important to remember, though, is that the US is no longer in Iraq. We can talk about the Iraq war.
Well, if you say so.
Yeah. Well, the occupation is officially over. The digressing a little bit, but essentially the main geopolitical function of the Iraq War was to convert Iraq into Iran's westernmost province. It wasn't about oil or the other line. Of course, the other line was, that they attacked Iraq because the evil Zionists infiltrating America forced us to get rid of one of their enemies for them, that sort of thing. But like you will notice that the majority of anti-Zionist themes are substantially similar to the propaganda that the Nazis were deploying against them. And the propaganda the Nazis were deploying against them basically comes out of essentially Vatican propaganda against the Jews. Hitler was saying that the Jews control the banks, right? So, hence, in the so-called truth movement, we hear all this stuff about, the Rothschilds, and there's a few, prominent Jewish bankers and so on that are wheeled out. Now, I would put on the table, I would chuck this on the table as a hypothesis that the globalist establishment quite deliberately has put in place certain
racial and religious archetypes so that they can garner support from whatever racial or religious archetype they want at any point. We've ticked off the people in Africa. Hey, well, conveniently, we have a massive banker from Zimbabwe here. Come on, Mugabe, put them all down for us.
Yeah, well, that sort of thing, yeah. But basically, the establishment, the core of it, is ideologically Greco-Roman. They would really love to have the world pretty much the way that the Greco-Roman Empire had it, so, of course, in a more modern context. Now, what happened is during the Enlightenment in Europe, which is where the tyrannical back of the Roman Catholic Church was broken, or at least the process of breaking it began, was the result of a guy called Baruch Spinoza in Holland, who was translating the works of, well, not so much translating, well, he was translating, but taking the works of a guy called Maimonides, who lived in, I think, 12th century Spain, and putting his themes, his notions of justice and civil rights, and to coin a cliche, all those other good things, in a way that aristocratic members, European aristocrats, Christian aristocrats, could understand and accept. And so as a result, you get what's called Western civilization. Now, by Western civilization, a lot of people will then equate that with things like McDonald's and consumerism and so on and so forth. What I would say is that's not really what it's about. That in spite of the numerous problems we have in the West, I'm not going to say that the West is perfect by any stretch. Otherwise, there'd be no need for a so-called truth movement. Hey. But the fact is, certain notions, such as equality before the law, civil rights, and so on, are entrenched now in Western culture, to the point now that the elites are forced to either try and undercut them or to make a mockery of them. In fact, I think consumerism is part of making a mockery of those very important themes. Sounds like we're going to another ad.
Yes, we are. Ladies and gentlemen, Nigel Waddington is my guest also for the second hour, and we're going to divulge further into the details. Now, the very first conversation I had with Nigel wasn't under such amicable circumstances, but I came round and got to listen to the man and just go, like, you know what? He's right. Isn't that very interesting? I never knew any of this stuff. And I'm sure most of the people listening, it's the same for you too. And if it riles you up and it kind of gets you angry or something, don't worry. Just because you're kind of starting to realise that you might have been deceived all these years. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieexpertshow.com.
Fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labour the point. And what have they ever given us in return? The aqueduct? What? The aqueduct? Oh, yeah, they did give us a... that's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans had done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without sand, don't they?
Well, apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation.
Medicine. Yeah. Education.
Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we've really misstated. The Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, road, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
All right. I love that, man.
bit of nothing like a bit of Monty Python absurdity. No one does absurdity like the Python.
There's no equivalent to the Pythons around today, man. That's what I've noticed.
No, I mean, comedians are still studying them.
Mm. Just genius. And you know what happens when you introduce fluoride into a society, right? If you only shift an IQ point, one little point to the left, you're half the number of geniuses.
Yeah, there's a whole thing about IQ tests, too. I mean, I think the IQ tests are essentially developed by eugenicists. Again, that's a whole other story. I think before we were talking about the reasons why the elites have repeatedly attacked Jews, quote unquote. And it's continuing to this day. So the same sort of themes that the same sort of propaganda that the Nazis were blatantly propagating are being distributed more in a more subtle way. So now, it's not, well, in some quarters of the so-called truth movement, they are saying, oh, the Zionists are taking control of governments and running the world and so on. A more moderate version of that is the Jewish lobby in the United States is forcing or directing the United States to do Israel's bidding for it. Now, this automatically creates an absurdity, because if there's a Jewish lobby dispensing propaganda in the United States that's making the United States do all these things for Israel, then why is it that the United States is actually attacking Israel? Now, I imagine a lot of people would be now, on hearing that, be going, what the hell is he talking about? The United States isn't attacking Israel. They give them billions of dollars of weapons and da-da-da-da-da-da. Well, the way the United States attacks Israel, and I must add, the full collaboration of the Israeli establishment, they do it in many ways, but one of the ways is by maintaining this charade called, it was called the Oslo peace process. Now, to get some idea of that, I don't know how much you remember about the first Gulf War, like back in 91, where...
I was like 6 years old. That's how much I remember.
Oh, okay. in that war, the United States basically crashed Iraq. And they did it primarily like a geopolitical purpose. The main geopolitical purpose was to weaken Iraq in comparison to Iran. Right. Now, what happened very soon after that, 91, was that the United States then put enormous diplomatic and economic pressure on Israel to force it into, I think it was called the Madrid Conference or whatever, and that morphed into the Oslo peace process, and that was to bring Yasser Arafat and his Fatah thugs to lord it over the Gaza and West Bank Arabs. Now, Fatah, what's Fatah?
Did they by chance call the Oslo peace process because it was oh so slow?
No, it's an Orwellian name because it's not a peace process at all and was never intended to be. It was essentially a sleight of hand to bring the Fatah, which was created by the Nazi movement, to get some idea of the history of that. Well, first of all, I guess I should plug a website where people can go and look at detailed documented research on all of this. Because what I say now might sound absolutely crazy to a lot of people, but so for anyone thinking that, I would direct them to the website hirhome.com. That's hirhome.com. HIR stands for Historical and Investigative Research. And its editor-in-chief, a guy called Professor Francisco Gil White. And he at one stage had a pretty nice job at the University of Pennsylvania. And he was illegally fired. Now, part of it was because he started exposing the Western media's propaganda against the Serbs during the 1990s Balkans Wars. But the thing that really, really pissed off his higher-ups was that he exposed that the Palestinian movement, which, of course, I'm not talking about Palestinian people, I'm talking about the political movement, the ones running the show, was descended from a senior Nazi, a guy called Haji Amin al-Husseini. And Haji Amin al-Husseini was appointed by the British during the British Palestine Mandate period as the Mufti of Jerusalem. And he was from what's known as the Effendi class of Palestine.
Did you say the Bookie of Jerusalem?
No, Mufti.
Mufti.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an Islamic title. Now with World War II coming on and so on, Haji Amin al-Husseini moved more towards the Nazis. He was involved in the pro-Nazi coup in Iraq, which also involved, I think, the Saddam Hussein's uncle. And then that was ultimately overthrown by the British. He then fled to Iran, and from there, I think he went to the Japanese embassy there, and then from there he went to Mussolini's Italy, and then from there to Germany. And there's pictures of him with Hitler and so on. And Hitler gave him a radio show and so on and so forth, and put him in charge of the Waffen-SS, which was like the Bosnian Muslim Nazi division. And he was co-architect with Adolf Eichmann of the so-called Final Solution. At the end of World War II, Yugoslavia put in a thing to, have him put on trial at Nuremberg and so on. He was put under house arrest in a luxury villa in France and then mysteriously escaped, where he popped up in Egypt, run by Gamal Abdel Nasser at the time, and he became the mentor, none other than Yasser Arafat and the current president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, or also known as Abu Mazen. So Fatah, basically is the PLO. And, it's quite a long and complex history, and people can go to hirhome.com, and there's a number of links. There's whole things on Israel and the Arab-Israeli conflict. There's also stuff on Yugoslavia and various other issues too. He's also done a very good analysis of the global warming scam as well, incidentally. So essentially, and another thing that's important to remember is at the end of World War II, the US intelligence alphabet soup, CIA and all the rest of it, were formed with the absorption of tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals. And
tens of thousands of Nazi war criminals.
Yes. Yes. This is all quite documented.
That's like off Operation Paperclip, right?
Operation Paperclip was part of it. So focusing just on Operation Paperclip is a bit of a whitewash because the operations extended beyond that. There was a guy, I'm trying to think of his name, Christopher Simpson. Christopher Simpson in 1988 wrote a book called Blowback, which documented all of this with, you know, like he'd done freedom of information stuff and so on, and he documented all of this.
So the Third Reich didn't lose World War II, they just changed venues.
Basically. But another thing that's important to point out, too, is that the Nazi movement would not have got anywhere if it hadn't been for the support of primarily US and but also British establishment figures. Most, if not all, of
the US gave. The US gave Adolf Hitler before the war something like $1 trillion at the height of the Great Depression.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But and also, it's not necessarily the US itself, right? But there were the various Baron families, such as the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the Harrimans and so on, who financed the eugenics movement.
And there was Prescott Bush as well, who was... He was managing a little bit of that money.
Henry Ford as well. So it could be said that the Nazi movement was an extreme, you know, it was a eugenics movement taken to extremes. So extreme that it actually discredited the eugenics movement somewhat. And so after World War II, the eugenics movement had to change its name.
Well, yeah, they had the American Eugenics Society, and they renamed themselves. What was it? Some obscure. Oh, yeah, Planned Parenthood.
Yes, yeah, the eugenics movement still exists in America, but it's hidden, and it lurks in the background. Like, yeah, I mean, yeah, all the stuff about the dangers of vaccines and all that sort of thing that can be traced to the eugenics movement. In fact. As you know, Dr. Len Horowitz has done a lot of research in that area. So essentially it would be bizarre in the extreme if the American establishment, who funded and created the Nazi movement and then absorbed it back into itself at the end of World War II, was suddenly pro-Israel. It would take quite a stretch for that to be the case. Now, combining with this, and this is where this whole thing does start to become very complicated, and so it's not surprising that a lot of people, both pro and anti-Israel, tend to get very confused, is that there was a certain segment of the Zionist movement which had pretty much a similar eugenics-type ideology to the Western establishments. And by that, like, a lot of people go, oh, yeah, well, we know all that because, you know, the Israelis, they're practicing eugenics against the Arabs. No. If you actually look at the history of the eugenics movement in Israel, it was actually attacking other Jews. Like, for example, and there's a guy called Barry Charmish who's exposed this somewhat and various others too. If people want to look into it, they can Google, you know, the ringworm children, right? In the 1950s, I think it was something like 100,000 Sephardic Jewish children had their brains irradiated with obscenely high levels of
up X-ray. To 10 times.
Oh, I think even more than that. But either way, it was purportedly to deal with ringworm. But the fact is that the vast majority of these 100,000 Sephardic Jewish children either ended up dying of all sorts of horrible things, brain tumours and the like.
although they're so damaged that you know, a lot of them are at the fringes of Israeli society today. No, they did not irradiate the heads of 100,000 Arab children. It was 100,000 Jewish children. So that's, if you like, that faction of Zionism called Labour Zionism could be seen as the, you could look at it as the Nazi infiltration of the Jewish movement. And it's that faction which is essentially in control of the Israeli body politic today. And it is that faction which is facilitating this charade of a peace, of a peace process. And I believe that one of the main functions of the whole of the Palestinian movement is to demoralize Israel, to throw it off track, so that all sorts of other things can call into play as well. So we've now got the Muslim Brotherhood have taken over Egypt fully with US support. That they've pretty much taken over Libya with full NATO bombardment support. It looks like they're getting set to take over Syria. So Israel is basically being surrounded. I mean, it always has been, but now it's like we're going to another ad break.
Yeah. I was going to say, so it kind of sounds like, I don't know.
The barbarians are massing at the hills, Emperor. What will we do?
Well, I could be looked at that, looked like at that, but...
Well, anyway...
I guess we can talk about that after the
stereotype. Right back, ladies and gentlemen. TiffanyExtraShow.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go freaking nuts. My very special guest is Nigel Waddington. Is it Waddington or Waddington? It matters.
That's
not.
Waddington.
Spellings. Waddington, okay. www.hirhome.com is the website. And another site to plug is emperors-clothes.com. That's emperors-clothes.com. That's emperors with an O. All right, Nigel, welcome back. Where were we?
Oh, going freaking nuts. we're talking about the geopolitical maneuvers in the Middle East at the moment. One of the things that's of great concern to a number of us who are doing this kind of research on the web is that the next genocide of Jews is being prepared. The groundwork is being prepared. And it's being engineered by the establishment. Now, one thing I want to make clear is I don't want to be fatalistic about it. It's not inevitable, but it's rapidly getting close to becoming imminent. And it is the reason it is happening is essentially for the reasons we've been talking about, that the tyrannical elites see the Jewish movement as a threat. And they've had to tolerate it and, adapt to it somewhat, particularly in the Western world. I think that they are now trying to make their final move to wipe it out entirely. That, like, going by the evidence of what's happening, not only on the geopolitical front, but by looking at the propaganda within the West, particularly directed at people who are purportedly interested in things like social justice and truth and so on, looking at the kind of propaganda that is directed at people like that, it's not looking good, and it's a real concern that that people who are purportedly interested in social justice are, in effect, attacking the movement which essentially spawned a lot of the ideas which they embrace. And that, I believe, if I had to sum up in short order why the Western counterintelligence systems are dispensing this kind of propaganda, it serves a number of agendas. One thing, and this is very important, it creates absurdity within people's minds. If people start believing things which are just patently not true and demonstrably untrue, they're embracing absurdity, and that inhibits people's abilities to think properly. And if people can't think clearly and with clarity and with discernment, then they're not really going to be much use against a sophisticated adversary, such as the global criminal syndicate. Another key reason, I believe, is that it effectively turns Jews who might be interested in helping these movements away from them. So, for example, put yourself in the shoes of someone who's Jewish or someone who's Israeli, who's sort of aware of some of the agendas unfolding, the global banking scam, fluoridation, you name it. They're starting to become aware of this sort of stuff, and they go on the web to have a look, and just about every forum they go to that discusses these issues is also basically telling them that you're a monster, you're Jewish, and the Talmud says this, and all these things which simply aren't true. It's quite understandable that they'd be turned off by that, right? And that's the other part of the agenda, is it starts to push Jews more into the pro-Western establishment camp. That is why a lot of forums that are purportedly pro-Israel back the United States, even though a lot of them are sort of going, oh, no, but Obama is no good and this sort of thing. Unfortunately, because the anti-establishment movement is so poisoned with a lot of these anti-Zionist and often outrightly anti-Semitic things, the other camp, which doesn't have those things, at least not so overtly, is pro-establishment. So it's an absolute mess, right, like that. So they are the key reasons for it. And also, I believe that the purpose of this propaganda is to utterly discredit the Jewish movement, so that if the establishment is successful with their plans to commit, the final genocide on the Jews, that the Jewish movement will be so discredited in the eyes of the world's people that it will be extremely difficult, if not impossible, for it to reemerge. That is my real concern, and that is why I focus on it. Not because I'm some mindless Israeli file or anything like that, but that I can see from the point of view of a bigger picture that there is a very real reason why this kind of propaganda is being dispensed.
Okay, so that's the bad guys want to get rid of them. Why the bad guys got something against the Jews?
Well, like we were discussing before, the bad guys being tyrants, the Jewish movement is specifically anti-tyrant. I mean, there are all sorts of things within the Torah, and there are other people who can articulate this better than I can, but there are all kinds of facilities within the Torah that make it quite clear that you've got to treat other people with respect. Even, this is one of those ironies. People will often say, oh, the Jews are into slavery. They talk about slaves in the Torah and da-da-da-da. Well, that's because within the context of the Torah, slave basically means employee, right? Making it a bit simplistic.
Well, that's interesting, because my definition of being an employee is being a slave.
Oh, not necessarily. Not if it's an amicable relationship and a fair and just one. And the point is that the Torah has all sorts of things that masters cannot mistreat slaves. It would be better to say masters cannot mistreat servants. So, for example, within the Torah, there's all sorts of codes saying that a master who does mistreat his servant has to basically let that servant go and continue paying and things like that. So, like I said, there are other people who can articulate that better than I can. But the point is, the Jewish movement has traditionally been anti-tyrant and anti-tyranny, and that is why the tyrannical factions within the elite want to get rid of it. It's a threat to them.
Okay. So, and that would be the reason why there's a massive anti-Zionist, anti-Jewish, pro-Nazi sort of eclectic bunch of factions out there that are all coming from it from different angles, basically just so that they can get a religion, which is what being Jewish is, wiped off the map because it specifically doesn't want tyranny and it stands in the face in terms of belief structure against the tyrants who want control of the entire place.
Basically, yes. And they, so far, have been very successful in doing it. Now, I'm hoping, you know, with my little humble efforts, and the humble efforts of just a few other people that are on the internet, to at least get the message out there that, hey, this is propaganda and you're being misled. And I am enlivened by the fact that a lot of people who get caught into the anti-Zionist camp aren't doing it, you know, aren't doing it to be, you know, because they're hated. They've been led there because they've been led to believe that Zionism is all about tyranny and global control and that sort of thing.
Now, what actually is Zionism then, if it's not just all about control and enslaving people?
Well, there are a number of different interpretations of it, but within a political concept, Zionism is about the right of the Jewish people to live safely in their traditional homeland, which is what used to be called Judea, right? And so in that sense, it is on a par with movements of indigenous activists in various countries throughout the world who are seeking sovereignty within those countries. So Australian Aborigines, Maoris in New Zealand, what are called the Indians in America, or in the Americas, because they're throughout there. There are various indigenous movements throughout the world, and I would put it on the table that Zionism can be seen as the political movement of the indigenous Jewish people. And in fact, if people Google Zionist Freedom Alliance, well, unfortunately, the Zionist Freedom Alliance website no longer exists, right? But there are blogs. So if people Google Zionist Freedom Alliance and declaration, they will actually find the declaration of the Zionist Freedom Alliance. And if they read that, you'll be very hard-pressed to find anything much in the declaration of the Zionist Freedom Alliance which is in any way offensive. It's very much about liberation and about forming honourable treaties with other groups, with, you know, around the Middle East and so on.
So yeah. Kind of the word Zionist has been turned into a bad word by the truth movement the same way conspiracy theorist has been turned into a bad word by the establishment, just to demonise people.
In a sense, though the term conspiracy theorist is also has been turned into a bad word by the truth movement itself, because there are so many people within the truth movement who fit the stereotype of the crazy, rambling conspiracy theorist that it's almost as though they're playing the role which the Western media then pulls them up on, you know what I mean? There's different interpretations of Zionism, but that is the one I basically go with. And certainly if you ask any anti-Zionist, like particularly the ones who are talking about global control and stuff, they're saying that it's about global control, what a Zionist is, they generally won't be able to answer you. And when they start saying things like, oh, the Zionists did the Russian Revolution and so on and so forth. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Well, then you can tell they're skirting the shoals of absurdity, because for most of the history of the Soviet Union and Israel, the Soviet Union was an enemy of Israel. You know, the Soviet Union backed a lot of the various Arab states which were attacking Israel. So, and also, if you actually look at who backed the Bolshevik Revolution, you'll find it's essentially the same elites who backed the Nazis and who dominate the U.S. Federal Reserve and the U.S. Body politic in general.
And the same people who financed the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and goodness knows what, however many other conflicts that they've been involved in, you know. It's just the same two sides of every major conflict. In fact, this pretty is interesting because it's Anzac Day. I wanted to call up, you know, New Zealand Talk Radio, and so I say that over air, you know, full respect to the troops and everything who have died, but all I'm saying is they died to serve an agenda of ruthless criminal psychopaths with copious quantities of cash who are playing both sides for their own ends, and your loved ones who died so long ago died as martyrs and puppets for pieces of trash who didn't care about their lives whatsoever. And an entire generation of young, upstanding, the most honorable men in society wiped out.
That is basically it. And that is one of the things that really pisses me off, actually, is that if you like, some of the themes which might attract people to the military, which is basically if you mess with me and people I care about, you're dead, are not in and of themselves a bad thing. We need warriors. Right? What really pisses me off is that they get used by snivelling weaklings, right, who sit in ivory towers, who, yeah, don't give a toss about them and use them for all sorts of nefarious agendas. Yeah, I mean, that has to stop.
Now, see, is there anything inherently unpatriotic or disrespectful for the dead that I've said there? I don't think so.
No, I didn't detect anything.
But that opinion, oh, my God, how few people would really have the guts to actually say that opinion on today of all days, you know, in a public forum, because it's the truth and people will be offended. You know, you're saying my grandfather died as a puppet or something like that. I'm not saying that. Okay. The whole world is rigged. And unless you want the next generation to be sacrificed in some kind of over bloated blood fest ritual, financed umpteen times by the labour and future generations' wealth, if you want that to happen again, by all means, keep ignoring the truth. And keep honouring people that died and not the reasons why they died and how much of a tragedy it actually really is. The truth is not remembered about their passing. That we continue to perpetuate lies that allow future generations to die for the same reason. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeselshow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's our final segment with Nigel Waddington. Website is hirhome.com as well as emperors-clothes.com. You wanted to round off today's interview by talking about the law.
Oh, well, not specifically, but just one thing I do want to make clear for the listeners is that hirhome.com and emperorsclothes.com are not actually my website, but they are websites I would recommend for people who want to research the sort of stuff we've been talking about.
You have a YouTube channel, don't you?
Yes, my YouTube channel is Changeling9AU. So that's Changeling9AU. That's my YouTube channel. I haven't actually made any videos for a couple of years. I plan to get back into it pretty soon.
Okay. Well, I mean, today, here we are. We're going to make a YouTube video out of this, I guess. So.
Yeah, well, I'll certainly share around with all my subscribers and so on.
Yeah. All three of them.
I'll probably upload it onto my channel.
Yeah, no worries, man. That's what it's all there for, eh? You know, so probably cut it up into segments and stuff. Right. Well, have we lost you?
No, I'm here.
Okay. Phew. I was just thinking something just went wrong there, but nothing went wrong. It's all good. Panic averted. So.
Did you say something about a letter or something you wanted to read out?
Well, I guess it actually does illustrate some of the stuff that I go through in the background here, but it's kind of, I guess I've elucidated. I have to elucidate. Anyway, this is a message from Bradley Thunderbird Phoenix, who was supposed to be on the show today. We had a mix-up, and I sent Nigel the American time zones. So for him, it would be tomorrow. But he thought it was today. And so my guest today sends me this email saying, I tried to communicate you that with this Wednesday was my birthday and I'm not working on this day until 5 p.m. Mountain Time, which is 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And my name is Bradley Thunderbird Phoenix. I've been calling him Bradley Starbird, unfortunately. And not Bradley Starbird. We're not communicating. I told you my work schedule and I told you my name. What the F is going on? F is abbreviated. So, piss on the interview, I don't want to do it, and that's the end of any communication between us. My God, you know, I'm such a horrible person. I got his name wrong and didn't answer an email promptly enough. I could have just flipped him over to tomorrow because Nigel was coming on today. That was all that had to happen, but he doesn't want to come on. But it was so convenient, just automatically, just boom, here's Nigel. And then I get a message from Tom Filer, who's an associate of Lindsay Williams, who does Wall Street trading and stuff like that, and helps people, particularly retired couples, keep their wealth and so they don't go bankrupt during the upcoming any crises and stuff like that. And he's going to come on for 2 hours tomorrow, and hopefully we'll take some callers and give the listeners the opportunity to call in and get some financial advice from a real pro. Now, when things slot in like that, just bang, 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 one person's rude to me, and then all of a sudden two cool dudes show up for me. The life of Vinnie Eastwood, I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, is a blessed existence, and I acknowledge every minute of it. And it's freaking awesome. Well, particularly yourself, Nigel. I was really glad that you turned up today, man.
Well, it's lucky because I thought it was on for today. But because of the times you gave me were in the American time zone, it would have actually been tomorrow, in which case I wouldn't have been able to come on because I'm due in the Victorian Supreme Court tomorrow.
Well, mate. Well, tell us what you're going to do in the Supreme Court tomorrow then. Oh, unless it's sub judice, eh?
Don't know.
Did you get the pun there? Sub judice?
what I'm doing tomorrow is appealing to a judge of the Supreme Court against the decision of an associate judge.
If you're appealing to a judge, do you have any small boys for him?
No. See, I'm actually of the view that the main problems with the processes of the law, well, like if you look at a lot of the, like the sovereignty, if you want to call it the sovereignty or common law movement or whatever you want to call it, look on their websites, they'll all constantly go on about the corruption of the judiciary. Now, while no doubt that there is a certain amount of corruption within the judiciary, I don't think that's really our main problem. I think our main problem is that most people are wholly ignorant of the law, or not even ignorant, but unaware. And so you have all these Pied Pipers within these grassroots law movements who typically, apart from anything else, will spout the usual anti-Jewish and anti-Zionist lines too. It's directed at, you know, that's one of the target audiences. The kind of propaganda we've been talking about today is if you like, grassroots law movements. They typically, these Pied Pipers will say the following two things. They will say, you have all these rights and you can do all these amazing things and da-da-da, and you look at the law, you can, you know, there's all these things you can do. And then they will then say that the judiciary are corrupt, so you can't actually do it. So, in other words, it's
it's a memeplex that is designed to neutralize people. Because you're telling people you've got all these rights, but hey, you don't. So what I'm trying to do, what my particular matter is about, cut a long story short, I had a civil matter in one of the magistrates' courts. The magistrates' court is like the lowest on the rung in the hierarchy of courts. And I wanted a friend of mine to present my case for me because he's had more courtroom experience and so on. And I sought leave from the magistrate to have him appear for me because I'd assigned him a power of attorney. The magistrate wouldn't have a bit of it. The magistrate was a complete a-hole, basically. So I adjourned the matter and so on, and then launched what's known as a judicial review. Now, a judicial review is where you take a matter of law, which includes denial of natural justice, to one of the Superior Court, which in the case of Victoria is the Supreme Court of Victoria, for adjudication on a point of law. And I've got about 3 minutes left, have we? Yep.
That's right.
And it went before an associate judge, and she gave me a very fair hearing. You know, I've got no complaints about the way she conducted the hearing and so on. But ultimately she ruled against me, particularly on the issue of power of attorney. And her reasons with respect to her, there was numerous flaws with them. So I'm appealing to a judge of the Supreme Court to because my matter was thrown out on the basis that it had, quote, no real prospect of success. And I believe it does it and can demonstrate that it does have a real prospect of success. So I'll find out tomorrow whether the judge of the Supreme Court agrees with me or not.
Well, let's see if it does. And, you know, court corruption, it's kind of like hit and miss. I've found some judges are actually still, you know, good, decent people. And then there's other judges in many cases that are well documented, at least in New Zealand, by Vince Seymour at kiwisfirst.co.nz, explored massive holes in the system. Like, it was like 180 judges, and like 60% of them are related, like by first cousin or something, at least.
Oh, yeah. No, well, that's true. But the important thing to remember is, like, particularly once you get to the level of the Supreme Court, is they can't just rule against you for the sake of ruling against you. They have to provide reasons. And so, and there have been numerous rulings throughout the West, and certainly within Australia at the Supreme Court and High Court levels, that the primary function of the courts is to ensure justice through the application of the due process of law. So you've got to remind them of that. And if you put that to them and like I'm basically of the view that ultimately if your cause is just, like if you're not just trying to get out of something or screw somebody over with by using the legal system, if your cause is essentially just, the law will ultimately support you, but there are hurdles in the way. And my particular matter of power of attorney, I believe, is extremely just because it seems to me that the standard practice is that a person can either represent themselves in court or have a legal professional do it for them. I'm arguing that a person should be able to assign power of attorney to someone who they know and trust, who is presumably more competent than they are at, you know, courtroom presentation, to present their case for them. So I'm making it clear that this is an issue not just simply for me in my particular matter, but is a matter of great public interest.
Mm. Okay. Well, Nigel, thank you very much for your time. And also, ladies and gentlemen, check out his website. Oh, sorry. His YouTube channel, youtube.com/changeling9au. It's changeling9au is the YouTube channel. We'll have links up on the VinnieEastwoodShow.com archives, as well as the other two websites that he recommends you look at, hirhome.com, emperors-clothes.com as well. Nigel, thank you.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're very welcome. Okay, now, lastly, before we go, I think we've finally got a bit, the music will be coming on right now. And I wanted to remind people that we're having a wee bit of a financial crisis over at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com because of the PayPal issues. A lot of people unsubscribed and didn't resubscribe. So if you are capable of contributing on a monthly, regular basis to help keep this show running, you can go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and either make an automatic payment directly into the bank account that is there, or you can click on the subscribe button and go through PayPal. $1 a month, $5 a month. One guy's even doing $50 a month as a donation. So that's what we need here in order to keep everything going without any hiccups, is a constant financial security, as we all do. And I very much appreciate it for the service that we do provide for you. We'll see you again sometime, folks.